Welcome to the meeting organised by the Socialist Party. It's a revival of our Sunday afternoon meetings. And today we got a guest speaker. Ed Griffiths is from the Oxford Communist Corresponding Society. And he's going to speak on falling statues and safe spaces, the right not to be offended as a threat to free expression. You've probably seen in the papers what they've been doing in universities, stopping people making views which the student union leaders have considered would be offensive to some people. And one of them, I think, was in Oxford. So that's the falling statue one, I think. But anyway, Ed is going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then we can have questions and discussion. So over to you, Ed.
Well, thanks very much, Adam. Thank you for coming along. And I'm grateful to the... Socialist Party for having me here and providing me with this platform. And I suppose that's part of the problem with this topic, that you can't even get through the opening pleasantries without getting into platforming and no platforming and safe spaces and unsafe spaces. And I hope nothing that I have to say will offend anybody too grievously. And I'll try to keep it brief because I'm going to be mounting some kind of defense of free speech, and it would seem a bit off if I then talked out the meeting myself and didn't allow anybody else to get a word in edgeways. So, as far as I can, I'll aim to keep within the 20 minutes. This is, as Adam says, an issue that's come up, or a group of issues that have come up, particularly in student politics or student union politics. And I'll speak towards the end about the specific Oxford example with the statue of Cecil Rhodes. But the general case is an issue that arises within a particular organisational model of student unionism. A student union isn't like a trade union, although it purports to be, but it's more like an official body that is part of the National Union of Students, which itself is heavily officially regulated, even in ways that trade unions are not. But the model that we're thinking of is where there are lots of student societies and they're all affiliated to the student union. And the student union provides venues for meetings and things like that. And in return, the societies have to abide by rules that the student union lays down. Obviously, there's nothing to stop a group of students from getting together outside that framework and organising their own meetings in the room over a pub, and some may do that. But within the framework of the official student union, they are obliged to follow the rules that are centrally laid down, some of which come from the National Union of Students and some of which are determined locally. And what that includes increasingly, I mean, I think this is something that began in the United States and has come over here, is the idea that views should be excluded from that framework if some group of students is likely to find them offensive or distressing or upsetting. Very often this refers to views that we would not be likely to agree with, that the views would be found offensive because they are racist or because they are misogynistic. So on occasion it might be views that we would be inclined to agree with. There have been cases where religious student societies have complained about atheist or secularist material being distributed because it offends their religious sensibilities. But often you can see a degree of legitimacy to it, even if we end up disagreeing with it, that in a sense, why should Jewish students have to hear a meeting by Holocaust deniers? Why should women have to hear misogynist speeches delivered within a campus that is in some way meant to be their home as well as their workplace. But I think nonetheless, this is a road that we don't want to go down for at least two reasons. One is a reason of principle why we ought to want to stick up for freedom of expression. And the other is potentially a reason of self-interest. The reason of principle is that freedom of speech actually is worth defending in its own right. That if we think that Marxism is a correct way to understand the world, then it ought to stand up in debate, and we should be able to argue it convincingly without trying to shut down opposing views or say, oh no, you can't go around saying that. And in general, you're more likely to get to the truth through a free debate where opinions can be expressed, even if they might cause offence. If you ban some opinions, that gives them the credibility of being martyred. It makes it look as though those are dangerous ideas that you can't defeat in open debate. So all you can do is to ban them. This is something that the early Christians knew very well, that martyrdom helped their cause. Being banned made them stronger. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And nobody is martyring racists on university campuses, but an enormous noise can be made whenever a right-wing journalist is prevented from speaking or something like that. And we want, I think, I mean, probably the arguments for a presumption in favour of freedom of speech ought to be quite self-explanatory. The second reason, I said, would be a reason more of self-interest, which is that these same arguments could be used at the drop of a hat to close down Marxist or socialist opinions being presented on campus if anybody wanted to. It would really be trivially easy for somebody to say, well, when you say Marx, that reminds me of Stalin, and I find that offensive and upsetting. So, and it doesn't matter that you don't mean it that way, because what matters is that to me it causes offence and it causes distress. So just like we don't allow these other forms of speech that might offend people, we shouldn't allow anybody to go around talking about Karl Marx or about socialism. Very easy argument to make, very difficult argument to refute once you've accepted the principle that there exists a right not to be offended, and that views that you find offensive should be excluded from debate because you find them offensive. As a matter of fact, there are all kinds of views that I find offensive and that I would rather people did not hold, and I'd rather people didn't advocate them. But for me then to say, well, I want to ban those, put them on a prohibited list, I would have to be very confident that nobody's ever going to try the same trick on me. And I don't think we can be that. I don't think we can be that confident. This is in the context of student unions or student politics, but it relates to wider debates about laws prohibiting incitement to racial hatred. And then incitement to religious hatred. Well, why should the next one not be incitement to class hatred? And then you can close down a lot under that rubric. Even incitement to religious hatred, I'm sure none of us would feel that what we do when we talk about religion is inciting hatred against individuals or groups, but it can be, but it can perhaps be presented in that way. I think there are dangers, and there is a drift away from a presumption in favour of free debate towards the exclusion of opinions that anybody might find offensive, which leads to, if it doesn't lead to blanket bans, it leads to self-segregated little groups where we go and sit over here because we don't want to hear the offensive things that anybody's saying over there, which means actually we don't engage with them, we don't persuade them that we're right and they're wrong. And if by any chance they're right and we're wrong, we don't get to hear about it either. So I think we have to accept the reality that being offended and being upset can happen in normal debate, even if somebody is not trying to be provocative, even if somebody is not trying to get a rise out of you. Sometimes you think, oh, damn it, that's so stupid. How can you possibly think that? And so on. That, incidentally, is much the way we ought to go, I think. Rather than taking offence at things people say, we should think, well, why would you, in fact, think that? If views are expressed that we don't agree with, rather than responding with anger or with upset, it's much more productive, I think, to respond by trying to understand the roots of those ideas, trying to understand the basis of them. You may then be able to refute them, but even if you can't, it's given you a... it's given you more of an insight into what's going on. So if somebody expresses racist views, rather than getting offended by it, it's probably more helpful to think, well, how does that relate to relations of power between, you know, the British Empire and subject peoples? How have these ideas been promulgated and built up in order to set one group of workers against another? How are these reflecting actions and policies of the British capitalist class and the British capitalist state going back, in some cases, hundreds of years? And then you can see it not as a moral failing of the person who expresses those views so much, but as one product or one result of relations of property and relations of power and the history of the society that we're living in. You might even be able to make that clear to the person you're talking to, that the things that they would like to blame on immigrants, that they've been told to blame on immigrants, are really not the fault of immigrants at all. But having mentioned the history of the British Empire, that sort of brings me on to the Cecil Rhodes issue in Oxford. One of the Oxford colleges, Oriel College, has a statue which is technically on public display, although it's almost invisible. I mean, it's above eye height, and you never normally, in fact, see it. Before this issue came up, it used to be a sort of notorious secret that hardly anybody in Oxford, you know, that you walk down the high street and you don't see the statue of Rhodes. You don't see it unless somebody's pointed it out to you. But a statue of Cecil Rhodes, because he donated money to the college, money that had come his way as a gold mining baron and militaristic prime minister of the Cape Colony. I mean, thoroughly a disreputable human being. And so the idea has been proposed that the statue ought to be removed, that it causes offence to South African students in Oxford now, to see this statue celebrating and glorifying a figure like Cecil Rhodes. No, I think that's mistaken. And I would much rather, if anything, that the statue were brought down to street level and made more prominent so that people did have to see it and say, oh, hang on, who is this Cecil Rhodes then? And why is he famous, and why has he got a statue here, and so on. Now, I would say that in the context of the general problem, as it seems to me, that people in this country have almost forgotten the British Empire altogether. It's not, in fact, celebrated very much. It doesn't seem to me that we're always being told about the glories of the British Raj, or stories about Napier sending Peckarvy in a telegram, or Clive not killing himself, or Gordon at the fall of Khartoum, or Allenby taking Jerusalem. All of these, which were once the iconic stories and the kitsch and the heroism that encouraged people to support the project of the British Empire, those have been forgotten, in fact. And it's not that people remember the crimes of it either. I mean, people don't remember... in Britain, I say, people don't remember Amritsar or the Bengal famine or the Kenya emergency. I'm sure in India and in Kenya, people remember those things a bit more. But I think there's something extraordinary about the fact that those episodes have been almost entirely airbrushed out of history, the way it's taught in schools, the way it's presented through films and television and so on. Really, everything closes down between the 17th century and the 20th. Very little coverage of anything in that window when you wouldn't be able to avoid talking about the British Empire. And if anything, I think it would be, by removing the statue of Rhodes, you would be contributing, in fact, to that airbrushing. It would just become an empty niche that then nobody would ask, well, hang on, didn't Oriel College get lots of money out of South African gold mines operated by black African mine workers for the profit of British capitalists like Cecil Rhodes? It would just, we haven't changed anything. We haven't stopped the exploitative relations that continue to exist, but just we've got rid of the symbol, and we don't have to remember it anymore. We don't have to think about it anymore. Just like we don't think about the British Empire in India, or we don't think about all kinds of unsavory aspects of Britain's past. And on that basis, I think it's it's, if anything, a good thing that there is a statue of Cecil Rhodes in Oxford. It's good that Oriel College has to explain why it's got that statue. Just like it's good rather than bad that another of the colleges, University College, has a portrait of Bill Clinton. And another of them, Somerville, has a building called the Margaret Thatcher Centre. Well, that tells you something about Oxford University. It tells you something about those colleges. And brushing it under the carpet and changing it to inoffensive names and portraits of people and statues that nobody could take offence at would not change any of that substance. It would not stop Oxford University being closely tied into the capitalist British establishment. It would just mean it wasn't visible, it wasn't celebrated. So that's up to a point a different argument in detail from the argument about free speech on campus more generally. Where they're connected is by the idea of avoiding giving offence or closing down anything that might cause offence to anybody. And I think the best response from socialists is not to ridicule the fact that people are offended by some of these things. I mean, in a sense, if you are South African, you are descended from black workers who were exploited by the British and then exploited under apartheid and are still exploited now, then certainly who am I to say you shouldn't get upset at seeing Rhodes? I tend to think it's good, you should. I mean, anybody, in fact, ought to think, crikey, Cecil Rhodes. That's a bit beyond the pale, isn't it? But what we do with that shouldn't be to say, well, let's shut up the offensive thing, take away the statue, stop people expressing racist views that are still being actively promulgated by a society that is still involved in foreign colonial wars now. We shouldn't concentrate on the symbols. We should think the reason why these are upsetting is because the reality needs to be changed rather than just the symbols. In particular, we shouldn't, and this is a side issue, but on the Rhodes thing, an argument that some people have made to oppose the idea that statues should be removed is by saying, but Rhodes was only, you know, a man of his time. You know, really in the 1890s, everybody was pretty much invading Africa and enslaving its people. And that's simply a slander against socialists and anti-racists and progressive-minded people in the past, who there were plenty of. Cecil Rhodes was not universally supported. His policies and the Boer War and so on were vehemently opposed by socialists like Belfort Bax and by other people as well. But simply a slander against people living in the past to say that they all thought like Cecil Rhodes, they all approved of Cecil Rhodes. I mean, you could say that we all now think like Tony Blair. Well, we don't all, actually. As I say, that's a bit of a side issue. But I think that's been about 20 minutes. So I will wind up and, in fact, stop. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.